Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by the venerable Mr. Michael Morris, who is in Cape Town. How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing all right as one can do when the world is falling apart around oneself.
I know.
And of course, we are also joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you doing?
I'm so glad that it's warm again. I feel very intimately connected to the weather, recovering a little bit still. And warmth is wonderful.
Mm. Indeed. And so for our first topic to be discussed today, we have, of course, yet another completely and utterly insane policy proposal coming out of government. And just before the show, I mentioned to my colleagues here, I didn't even know how much we could say about this because it's just such a bad idea. But anyway, the Social Development Minister, Lindiwe Zulu, has published a proposal in a green paper, which is looking at making so that all employers and employees will be obliged to pay into a government-run National Social Security Fund. And they will all be forced to contribute something between 8 to 12% of earnings up to the current unemployment insurance fund ceiling of 276,000 rand a year. So the proposed fund is based on, quote, social security principles of risk pooling and social solidarity. The most notable gap, this is the minister speaking, most notable gap in our social security system is the absence of a mandatory contributory public social security fund that provides retirement, disability, and survivor benefits to the workforce. Ha! Gabriel, let's start with you. Am I being uncharitable when I say that it's a bad idea to essentially cut everyone's wages by 10%?
I think I can imagine and even find in history examples of this kind of fund that work in other countries with other governments that have already established a kind of credibility.
Right.
It's really important. I don't know, this principle of the basic principle of credit actually applies very much to government. So if someone wants to borrow money from you, then it's best if they can prove that they've borrowed money before and they've paid it back. And it's okay if they can't prove that, but they can at least prove that they know how to manage some money. And maybe if it's a completely blank slate, even that's okay. But if this person has definitely borrowed money from you yesterday and lost it, then you can't lend them money today. Like if they've got an aggressively negative track record, then you can't lend them the money today. So in terms of any resources in the economy getting redirected from private hands into government administration, you have to look at what the track record is. And the track record is that the second highest line item on our books is servicing debt, is just interest payments on our debt. That we're spending more on that than health, for example, even during a pandemic. That's a sign of how badly our fiscus has been managed. You can't give the same managers more funds to deal with. And it's not really, I mean, I think it's fundamentally flawed in another sense, which is that a pay-as-you-go social security system is requires different inputs. Like if you were to do this and then say you get a 10% tax break, that would be maybe interesting. But this is just on top of everything that else is already happening. And as Franz Krenier likes to point out, if you look over the last century of Treasury data, I mean, literally since the Union of South Africa in 1910, there has been no point at which the South African taxpayer has been more heavily burdened than right now. Not during World War II, not during World War I, not during the collapse of apartheid, has the government ever taken a greater share of GDP through its own administrative sieve. So we're very heavily burdened. Adding anything right now doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so that's the reason I framed it in such a negative way, is to say basically a 10% pay cut of everyone is that we've, as you said, Gabriel, there's in theory governments where this can work, but quite honestly, you actually have to have a pretty efficient government for something like this to work. I mean, for example, the United States has a social security system where everyone has to pay in some amount. And that system is actually slowly going bankrupt, despite the fact that it's such an enormously wealthy country. You basically have to be Switzerland in order to pull something like this off. It's not easy. And of course, we are not Switzerland. As Giulietta Talevi pointed out, you know, we do have some examples of government-managed funds, which are supposed to benefit people in a similar way, like the Road Accident Fund, which is not working so well. Michael? Do you have anything to add to this insanity?
Your mentioning Switzerland reminds me of the comment of our colleague Marius Rösch earlier this morning in a staff discussion that, you know, if we were run by the Swiss government, people might well say, well, let's consider this. And that's really the point. And you mentioned Talevi's piece too in Business Live. She makes this very point. You know, the deeper question is, how confident does this plan make you feel about the future? With its usual tin ear, the Department of Social Development has published this plan without any apparent awareness of just how fragile trust in the state is right now. That really is the key thing, is that people are going to be completely flabbergasted by the extraordinariness of the temerity, really, of even coming up with this. For me, the image that immediately comes to mind with these and other similar ANC plans is of a child sort of frantically rushing after a rapidly deflating balloon. And you have the sense of a government sort of in hot pursuit of fast dwindling resources, and all they're really going to end up with is a pup balloon. And it's one more thing that underlines so many of the arguments that we've been putting forward, that, you know, without economic growth, jobs, better education, and the housing, health and security that underpin the stable, prospering society, there's going to be this continuing need for, you know, what was it, 6.2 million people, I think the minister said, are in need of this assistance. That's only going to grow, and the resources to meet this need are only going to dwindle. So it really does bring us right back to the fundamentals of policy, and the point that you and Gabriel have made, that, you know, trust in the government's ability to handle funds of any kind is fundamental to it.
Right. And yeah, Gabriel, do you have anything further to add?
I think a small point, just this kind of talking point I've wanted to throw in for the last couple of weeks, is that after the riots of mid-July, the ransack, a lot of people kind of fumbled around for what the headline social problem is that we should ascribe this, this ransack to. And the answer increasingly has become inequality. And I think in a way, this is just another policy move that's supposed to manifest this urge to address the inequality problem. Now, this is a big thing to discuss. There are bad kinds of inequality. There are good kinds of inequality. But it just so happens that when we were doing the Racism is Not the Problem campaign, I noticed that just above racism, when we asked South Africans in our survey, what do you identify as the biggest two problems unresolved in the country? Racism was like number 15 at 2%, and number 14 was inequality at about 3%. Most South Africans really don't think redistributing the small amount of wealth that we have is a bright idea. Most South Africans think getting more jobs, which means protecting property rights so that people have an incentive to reinvest and grow their businesses here rather than ship whatever resources they have offshore, is a much better way forward. And that kind of common sense, grow the pie rather than shrink it and cut it more ways, attitude is just not penetrating the sort of echo chamber of policy creation in government. And it's a serious concern.
Yeah, no, exactly. I must say that what strikes me as so shocking about this is how incredibly short-sighted it is as a sort of from a political perspective, because it really seems to me now like the ANC has decided that basically their enemy is anyone with a job, and they're going to try and shovel as much money into their own hands and into the hands of those who are unemployed in the hopes to kind of bribe them into voting for them. And I think that's exactly why they're also proposing, you know, the basic income grant, which is not a terrible idea, but to propose such a thing just before an election always makes one a little bit suspicious. And
when you're so indebted and
exactly. And so this is a very short road that they're going down here. If they're going to triple down on the, we'll bribe the very poor to vote for us, and suck out the last pieces of vitality from the middle classes, you know, the strategy is not going to last long because the middle classes have not been doing so great for a while now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just last thing on that from me is that I like to remind people that if you look at capital to income ratios, in other words, how much wealth stock is there in this country compared to how much wealth is created every year? What's GDP? We just have the lowest that I can find anywhere. And not just now, like also across history. Now, that's not to say that there aren't lower capital to income ratios in countries like the Congo. I'm pretty sure that the Congolese capital to income ratio is even lower. But in South Africa, it's less than 2 to 1. So that means every 2 years we make more money than there is stored up everywhere. And that's just a sign of how eviscerated the middle class already is. It's already on the bones of its ass. There's no more room. But we're going to try and see how much there is to take still, I guess. It's very concerning.
Right. So let us go on to our next topic for today, and that is, of course, something that you have written, Gabriel, about your recent experience with COVID, and a question that is circulating for many people right now and has not been very well addressed by the media is, if you've had COVID, just how important is vaccination? Gabriel, can you tell us a little bit about the research that you've done and what you found out and all of that stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of started this journey with a friend saying, consolation prize, you've got COVID, but at least now you've got better protection than you would have had if you'd been vaccinated, because I was registered to be vaccinated last week. And I was very excited about it and very disappointed that I couldn't do it. And now I can't get vaccinated for at least a while.
I think the guidelines say something like a month,
Something like that. So I Googled it and I found a piece in The Guardian written by a sort of director of a health public health department at the University College of London saying, look, you get a little bit of protection out of recovering from COVID, but you get much more protection out of vaccination. It lasts longer. It's more robust against new variants, way better. And I was like, okay, where are the numbers? Like, how much longer does it last? How much more robust is it? You know, like, what is this, 95% versus 90%? You know, give me something to hang this on. Couldn't find anything. Did find a hyperlink to a piece in a Johns Hopkins, which is like America's top public health or medical school, one of the top three. And there was an interview with a virologist, immunologist, very fancy, many PhDs kind of person. And again, no figures, no studies, and no backup to the claim that vaccination is better. So then I did some of my own research. I found Nature kind of gives the best overview. They've got a piece which is kind of like a layman-friendly piece called What Have We Learned 1.7 Billion Doses Later? So there have just been a huge amount of vaccines that have already been administered, and Nature, which is kind of the most prestigious journal, went around not just within its own archives, but across a range to find what they thought were the most salient and important discoveries to be made from the vaccination analysis that's already been done. And they point to two studies that are very large, one in Qatar, one in the UK, with tens of thousands of subjects that indicate that convalescent protection, the protection that you get from getting sick and then recovering, is at least as strong as, probably stronger than, vaccine protection. Then there are more sort of fine-grained studies that show kind of why that is. One of the confusing things is that if you just test for certain kinds of antibodies that latch onto the spike protein of the virus, then the vaccine will do better. Like if you test someone's blood 6 months after they've been vaccinated and you test someone's blood 6 months after they've gotten the virus for this one specific kind of antibody, the vaccine person will have potentially a higher concentration than the person who recovered. But that's because that's kind of the main thing that the vaccine is triggering. And that kind of protection does dwindle from 28 days, just about 28 days, 31 days after you've gotten a shot. So that's why all the vaccine companies are talking about boosters. You know, AstraZeneca started with two, now they're saying you should have three. Janssen, Johnson & Johnson started with one, now they're saying you should have two. Because you can see the stable decline in those antibodies. But there are other ways that your body defends itself. Sentinel T cells, CD4, CD8, memory B cells, and not just those memory cells found in the blood, also those found and generated in bone marrow. And there are studies that show that those, especially the memory B cells, actually increase over the course of a year, basically, amongst people that are convalescing from COVID-19. So the body has a pretty strong protection. It's very hard to find people who've died a second time being infected with COVID. It's quite easy to find people who've died after being vaccinated of COVID. So that protection seems like the clearest one. But the point of this is not that one shouldn't get vaccinated if one's already had it. You're definitely a much lower priority, and I've been arguing from the start of the year that people who've already had it shouldn't get vaccinated, shouldn't be rushing to get vaccinated until everyone else has been vaccinated, because in a situation of limited resources, taking a vaccine away from someone who's a virgin, someone who's properly vulnerable, to make like a you've got 95% protection if you've recovered from COVID. From a proper COVID illness. To get vaccinated, maybe you go to 97%. So you're getting this 2% extra, whereas someone else would go from like 0% to 90% protected from the vaccine. So that seems selfish to me and like a bad thing to do. But now South Africa is in this position where so few people want to get vaccinated in any event that they've opened up vaccines to anyone over the age of 18. And so it's, we have limited resources, but we also have very limited demand. So I think in that situation, if you want to get vaccinated, you've already had it, go ahead. It's not like you're getting in the way of anyone else because most other people don't seem to want it. And it does seem to me from the scariest study, which basically does a kind of gain of function research, these guys generate a polymutant. They sort of concoct the scariest mutant version of COVID that they can. And they test that against people's plasma to see if you're vaccinated, can you block that? If you've recovered, can you block that? They find neither is good enough. No vaccine is good enough. No convalescence is good enough. But if you combine the two, then that is good enough. So I think combining the two, I feel kind of fortunate in a way. I'm very upset and I was very sick, but in a way I am fortunate because I will get vaccinated. And after I'm vaccinated, I'll be the most ahead of the curve as you can be. I think this plague is never going away. It's just going to keep evolving. And I'll have the highest tier of protection that a person can get. So, yay for me. But it's been like a really not very nice, I nearly swore there, journey.
So just before I get to you, Michael, because there's something I want to ask you very specifically. I see someone in the chat here is asking, Gabriel, do you think that after everyone has had a chance to get the vaccine, do you think they'll do away with the masks? That's an interesting question. And what we've seen in the US, which has got really high vaccination rates, is they brought back the masks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that governments have taken responsibility for something that they don't really have control over. And that's a scary pattern. Whenever that happens, it doesn't end well. And part of the reason for that is government can't admit, once it's taken responsibility, it can't admit that it doesn't really have the power to do what it's claimed it's able to do. So it's claimed the victories. It now can't say, well, actually, this is all beyond our control. And in a sort of in a well-ordered and unpanicked society, and you see some of them in Europe and many of them in the Far East outside of Beijing, China, in the democratic parts of the Far East, people kind of take personal responsibility. They make their own choices and they seem to be able to muddle through. And some people die, but it's sort of relatively low levels. Excess mortality is not that far from the usual year. Economic stability is there, growth is there, and they kind of get through. Governments didn't try to do everything. They didn't try and mandate masks. They didn't try and mandate lockdowns. They kind of did the least possible intervention, and they left the most to the people. In America, in Western Europe, governments have done as much as they can, and because the plague isn't going away, in my opinion, they don't have the control that they pretended they had all along. So the promise was always, look, we're going to take all of the responsibility. We're going to take all of the control. And this is not scary because we'll give it back as soon as this thing goes extinct. And I just think it's going to take, like another year or two for it to sink into some people's minds that this thing is not going away. And so the bargain that you make with your government to say, well, you get to tell me what to do all the time, that this is around until it goes extinct, that bargain is kind of a marriage rather than a summer fling. And I think everyone's down with a summer fling with a mask. I don't know that anyone wants to be married to the mask for life.
Not particularly. I just solved the problem by just normally not going outside, but that's just how I live my life. So, you know, this plague thing is for me a bit of an outside problem. But Michael, so the point that Gabriel makes at the end of his article, and I just want your thoughts on this, is that, and I think this, Gabriel would agree that this is definitely not the first time this has happened. There's this sort of feeling that a lot of public health officials have been kind of attempting to tell what they would describe as perhaps a noble lie, right? They don't entirely come forward with the exact clearest version of the truth. Sometimes they're a little bit muddled. Sometimes they outright obfuscate a bit because they don't want people to panic and they want people to do what they think is best. And that sort of condescending attitude, I really think, has done far more damage than good. Do you agree with my assessment? And
yeah,
do you agree with that?
I do indeed. There are just two things I want to share regarding Gabriel's piece, and I highly recommend people to read it because I think it's an excellent piece of work on various levels. But the friend who spoke to Gabriel, he mentioned right at the beginning of his contribution, is actually a gardener with no matric, and it demonstrates what one might think of as kind of the natural human wisdom that we all share, whatever our educational attributes. But there's this lovely last line, which I just thought was too good, where this fellow tells Gabriel, next time you must go to the Sangoma, at least that way you know it's magic. And this comes back very much to your point, Nicholas, about the nature of the authority of science and the way scientists are appearing often to rely on some unspoken basis of our trusting them and our kind of having to trust them. And of course, we don't really have to trust them. We need to be convinced. And this is a point that I think Gabriel brings out very, very effectively in the way that he explores the claims that are made in his piece. And it strikes me a lot these days in a world awash with data, and most of it presented in very much the same credible seeming way that good science is presented, unlike in the old days where you had maybe books versus pamphlets or Oxford University Press against some sketchy imprint with relied on cheap paper and kind of lack of proofreaders. A lot of people now fall for the idea that all knowledge and all data is valid and has authority because we can see it there. It's in black and white. It's on the screen. There's a chap who's got a PhD and he's telling us that, you know, science is rubbish or that creationism is the thing or whatever it might be. And I think this is also very much exacerbated by the very sophisticated search tools that we have available that so often make it far too easy for us to find the answer that we wanted rather than the answer that we didn't know. And this is actually what's reflected, I think, in the pieces that Gabriel mentions, where claims are made by scientists. And there's an insufficiency of corroboration to, in fact, endow what they're saying with the authority that they quite possibly have. And so on the one hand, there's this, you know, a kind of great and I think valid concern about the kind of rise of anti-science and people disputing what is verifiably known. And it's everything from, you know, the reams of nonsense that people talk about creationism
5G.
And 5G and all the rest of it, and that evolutionary theory is nonsense and so on. But it's precisely because of the seeming veracity of this drivel that we can, you know, we can find it, that there'll be charts attached to it, figures from all sorts of places, there'll be some authoritative seeming chap telling us it's all true, that I think scientists often fail to appreciate how difficult it is, if I speak for myself, for me to judge, people like me to judge what they say. And that's a challenge for me, but it's actually much more of a challenge for them, mainly because they can no longer rely on an assumed authority, the assumed authority in their knowledge, buttressed perhaps by the Encyclopedia Britannica or Oxford University Press publication, which comes with its own kind of imprint of or imprimatur of authority, and we can now all ferret out the details and make up our own minds. And if scientists don't provide the chapter and verse and don't reinforce the source of the authority, then in fact the authority of knowledge itself per se will be at risk. And I think that's very much your point. It's a great piece, Gabriel, that you've written today in very plain terms. Some of it is too scientific for me. I don't understand it, but he does exactly what the scientist should do, is to go through this process of trying to discover an answer. I highly recommend it. It's a very good piece. And it's a problem for science.
Yeah.
Right, so let's move on to our last topic for today. And Gabriel, there was a headline. We'll have to cover it very briefly, but there was a headline that caught your eye in The Citizen.
Yeah, so for those who can see this on YouTube, I'm holding it up. I really like The Citizen. It's kind of my favorite daily. But today its headline I just find very amusing. Private guns most stolen. Okay, so that's not too amusing, but the subtitle is, it is alarming that statistics suggest private gun owners and security firms lose more guns than the police. So the idea is, you know, if the police were losing more guns than private people, then that would be okay.
Unsurprising.
That would not be surprising. So it's kind of the most profound insult to the police that I've found yet. Is that their expectations of the police are so low that if you are losing more guns than the police, then you are shocking. Then you really, it's tickets for you. It's all over. Unfortunately, the police is not very, it's really not the best. It's not up to the Citizen's usual standard. It says figures suggesting about 700 firearms are lost every year. If you then read the piece, it turns out the 700 firearms are the lowest estimate of the number of firearms that the police alone lost in 1 year. The number that they give was 607, and then it was audited and taken up to 689. But this is disputed by independent statistics, which find that the police are losing thousands and thousands every year. The number of guns that have been lost from private hands is even larger, many thousands. But then there's a claim that in 1 year, in a 6 year period between 2013 and 2019, the South African Police Service lost over 10 million rounds of ammunition. And the Defense Force, the Army, can't account for 82,000 guns since 2011. So the sort of 700, the headline is like 700 guns are being lost a year, and more of them are being lost from private people than the police, which is terrible. Kind of just conceals this much darker story that's only going to get worse if the police are given the duty of confiscating the 1.7 million guns that are privately legally registered. If they already can't handle the guns that they've got, because there is right. no digital up to the minute registry. You just have
yeah, like the registries one... are a complete mess. And, you know, there have been, you know, cases that have been taken to court and people found guilty of the police selling guns that were handed over to them for destruction by civilians.
So this story also mentions a police person who was killed by a gun, and then the ballistics found that the gun at that moment was supposed to be in a police station on the other end of the country. So the police aren't just selling them to gangsters. The police are getting killed by guns that they've already confiscated. I shouldn't laugh, but I don't know. It's just such madness. It's so bad. And then you try and confiscate all guns.
Yeah, no. Anyway, something we'll obviously return to. I mean, we've talked about it quite a lot on the show recently, but you know, some of the government's proposals on firearms right now are just out of touch with reality. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today and indeed for this week. So thank you very much for watching. We hope that you enjoyed the show. We hope that you found it interesting. Please like, comment, subscribe, leave good reviews on the podcast apps, all that good stuff. We really appreciate all of that. And yeah, check out thedailyfriend.co.za. Anyway, I hope you all have a most wonderful and fantastic weekend, and we shall see you next week on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.